Philadelphia from their home in Kiev after they were warned that the Cossacks were coming. So Molly Picon grew up here in Philadelphia and began her theater career in the Philadelphia Yiddish Theater. She built her world reputation singing, dancing, and acting in the Yiddish theater, also on radio. One of the early films that she starred in during this period was Yiddle Mit the Fiddle. That was shot in Poland, and it's still being shown at film festivals around the country. Her more recent films include Come Blow Your Horn, Fiddler on the Roof, and For Pete's Sake. You also may remember her performance in the Broadway show Milk and Honey. Molly Picon has written her autobiography, which tells many stories of her life on the stage and her life with her husband, who was a writer, actor, and director who died in 1975. This new autobiography is called Molly, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Welcome to Fresh Air, Molly Picon.
Thank you, Terry. Now, that's quite a covering of what we want to do today. Most of it is absolutely correct. I started as a child here in Philadelphia. I was born on Broome Street in New York. And when I was 9 months old, my family moved to Philadelphia. And so I started my career here in Philadelphia on a streetcar, of all places. You know, most people, when they tell you their biographies, they start singing on corners or in saloons. I started on a trolley car. Now, that's the first story in the book. Do you want me to tell you that? Tell the audience that, or shall we just...
Why don't you tell that story, and then we'll take it from there.
Well, it's just that Mama was a dressmaker, and she sewed for the Yiddish theater actresses, the old Columbia Theater at 3rd and Green Street. And when they came for fittings, of course, I was a kid, and I used to do everything, stand on my head and do all those little shtick, you know. And they asked Mama why she didn't put me in the theater, because I could make 50 cents a night. Now, you must know that 50 cents was a lot of money in those days. And so Mama decided that was okay, and she made me a fancy dress and took me on a trolley car to the Bijou. Now, any Philadelphian will know that the Bijou was a burlesque house. And they had amateur nights on Fridays for the kids, and the first prize was a $5 gold piece, which I was hoping I would win. But on the car there was a drunk, and he looked at me and said, "Hey, kid, what are you all dressed up for?" And I said, "I am a singer, and I'm going to sing and win a prize." And he says, "Ah, come on, you don't even know how to sing." So Mama said, "Molly, show him." So I got up on the car and I did my whole act, and he passed around his derby and collected $2 in coins, which he gave to me. Now that, I consider, is my first paid professional performance in the theater. Then we went on to the Bijou, and I won the prize. And in those days, the audience used to throw coins at the kids. You wouldn't remember. That's way before your time. And I picked up those coins. You know, we came home to my grandmother. We lived with her because we couldn't afford our own flat. And Mama plunked down $10 on the kitchen table. Now, when my grandma saw that, you know, she almost fainted. She said, "How did she do it? You know, she's a genius," and so forth. So Mama said, "I'm going to take her every week to another theater, and she'll win the first prize, and we'll be able to have our own flat." And Grandma, who was very wise, said, "Look, Clara, in Philadelphia, you got maybe 6 or 7 theaters altogether. Why don't you better keep her on the trolley cars?" So that's how I started my career in Philadelphia, on the trolley cars.
Now, I think during that period, if your son or daughter went into the theater, it was a great source of embarrassment because the theater was not considered a reputable place for one of your offspring. Was it different in the Yiddish theater? Was that not an embarrassment for the parents?
Well, the only people that were embarrassed were people that were related to me. Now, our name was Picon. We had one cousin who, when he found out there was going to be an actress in the family, he changed his name to Pacoon. He didn't want to be known as the uncle of an actress. But I don't think we had as much feeling against the theater as people, because we loved theater, we loved music, we loved dancing. Our Jewish people accepted the theater. Whereas in the American theater and all other theaters, we were considered as outlaws, you know, for many years.
The part of the reason why people thought the theater was a terrible place for younger people to be was because of the morals, the loose morals. That wasn't your mother never worried about what happened backstage between the males and the females?
Well, first of all, I was only 5 years old, and she wasn't afraid that I would be attacked physically at that age. And then with us, it was not a question of theater or morals. It was just a question of making 50 cents a night, which was very important to us because we had no source of income. My father never worked. He was a very learned man. He studied Greek and Latin all by himself, and all he did was he collected bundles in the factories and brought them home for Mama to sew. And he never worked. He was always studying. He was a real Talmud student, studied the Bible and so forth. But he never earned a living, so Mama and I had to make a living. And that was the only reason I ever went into the theater, or that Mama put me into the theater, because that was a way of making 50 cents a night.
As you grew older, was there a conflict within you between the desire to assimilate completely into American culture and the desire to be Jewish and to speak Yiddish?
No, darling. In that time, there were so many Jews in one section of a town. It was as if it were a different country, and nobody felt anti-Jewish or pro-English. It was Yiddish theater, and we had very good Yiddish theater, good actors. We made a good living, more or less, you know, in the theater. And we had no feeling about it otherwise. You know, we weren't ashamed of being Jewish. We weren't afraid of being Jewish in those days. Although there were the little anti-Semitism, which we always have up until today. But we never felt it in the Yiddish theater, never at all.
What were some of the plays that you did that you feel still most strongly about now?
Well, to start with, as a child, it didn't make much difference. I played all kinds of parts, you know, and I played with the greats of the Yiddish theater because they came to Philadelphia on guest performances, the Adlers and Tomaszewski and Kessler and all the big actors. And I learned just from watching them. I have never had one lesson in any branch of theater. Not in acting, not in dancing, not in singing, nothing but just watching actors, and that's how I learned. And I began getting a little stage struck when I was 7 or 8 years old, when I began to realize that people were applauding me and they were laughing with me and they were petting me because I was a cute little girl or something. And that's the time I started feeling that I wanted to be in the theater and began to love the work I was doing. But it was hard work because we played until 12:30 at night, and I had to get up the next morning to go to school at 7 o'clock, and I did. I never missed a and you know that in school, the teacher always used me as an example. I was very tiny. Here she said as an example, and she'd stand me and have her hand on my head. Here is an example of what's going to happen to you if you don't get to bed early. You see what happened to this little girl? Because she goes to bed late, and she's an actress, you know. And I was held up as a bad example. But this didn't affect me at all because I loved the theater by that time. And they used to measure us in the gymnasium. They'd call out Betty Smith, 5'2", Annie Kadovsky, 5'4", Molly Picon, 45 inches. So I was always the little girl and cute. And people, you know, played with me and humored me and brought me little candies and so forth because I was an actress. And I used to stand on my toes in the school and walk backwards and forwards. I began to be a show-off, which I am until today.
When you became a woman, you were still short and still small. Did that affect the kind of roles that you could play? Did you have to create a new kind of image for an adult woman on the stage?
Well, I didn't create it, but Yankel did. Yankel was my husband, and I met him in 1918. I was in a vaudeville show at the time, going from one, what we called the Gus Sun time, to the Ackerman Harris time, to the New York time, to the Palladium time or whatever it was. And we got to Boston when the influenza broke out, that first flu that killed so many people, and they closed all the theaters, the American theaters. But there was a Yiddish theater in Boston at the time. And of course, I never had enough money to go from one town to another unless I was working. And I knew the actors that were in that theater because they had worked with me or I had worked with them as a child. So I thought I'll go to them and they'll give me the money to get back home to Philadelphia. And instead, I met Yankel and he persuaded me to stay with him. The theater was open. I said to him, "How come you're open when all the other theaters are closed?" He said, "Because nobody knows it's opened." So that he talked me into remaining, and he gave me $5 a week more than I got in the Goyish theater, see, the Gentile theater. So, of course, I accepted. And that's how I started. Now, I was very tiny. I wasn't the most beautiful kid in the world. And he felt that I had a certain kind of talent, and he was going to develop that. Now, what was he going to do with a kid, and, you know, under 5 feet? So he wrote me the first child star part that's ever been written in the Yiddish theater. And it was called Yankala, which is the diminutive of Yankel. Now, you know, Yankel is the Yiddish for Jacob, and Jacob is the English for Yankel, turned around. So he wrote me that first part. Now, this was produced in Boston with me, and I played a 13-year-old boy. I was 19 at the time, and there was a young actor in the theater who played my father. He was 2 years older than I, and his name was Muni Weisenfreund, and you know him, of course, as Paul Muni. So at that time, he already was playing old men with beards, and he did wonderful things with makeup. And so I played Yankala over 3,000 times all over the world. And very often, until today, people come and, you know, pinch me on the cheek and say, "Ay, Yankala, Yankala." They remember Yankala, and they also remember their own youth when they came to see Yankala.
Is that a nice experience for you when people see you and flash back to one of your early performances?
Darling, this is what keeps me alive in the theater. You know, Yankel died of cancer. 4.5 years of we had cancer. And the last few days that he was alive, he said to me, first of all, he said, "Molly, it's not a trick to drink from a full bottle. It's a trick to drink from an empty bottle." That was one of his sayings. And the last thing he said was, "Molly, you've got to go on working because it's the only way you know how to live." And so when he died, and after 3 months of not knowing what I wanted, I called my agent and I said, "Look, you've got to book me because I'm climbing walls." And then I started again in concerts. And I have found now a reason for living because my audiences immediately came back to hold me up, you see. And they have been following me or have been with me for almost 60 years. And even today, when I was selling books in one of the stores, they all came back and said, "I remember Yankala. I remember this," and in Philadelphia, in New York, in Boston, you name it, because we played all over the world. I've been around and around the world 2 or 3 times. And all over, as long as there were enough Jews around, I played in Yiddish. Then I started playing in whatever the language of the country was. So I finished up by playing in English, in French, which I speak, and in whatever language I had to learn.
You mentioned Paul Muni a couple of minutes ago and how his name was Muni
Weisenfreund.
Yeah, a lot of people who started in the Yiddish theater eventually changed their names, anglicized their names, or developed completely new ones and moved on to Broadway or to films, and we now know them as stars by other names. When you saw that happening, did you feel at all betrayed that it was people leaving the tradition, or was there no alternative? Did that seem like a very common sense thing to do?
Well, no. You know, the Yiddish theater was very much alive until 1940, I think. And so there was no reason to resent people going into the American theater because we had enough actors, we had enough theaters to perform in. Then it started dwindling a little bit. First of all, the immigration was cut down, and that immigration all started going to South America. And then the people started moving out of the neighborhood because the neighborhood was changing. And they moved to Long Island and Queens and so forth, and it was very difficult for them to come to Second Avenue. And then, of course, the Holocaust. 6 million Jews, a source of our writers, our composers, our actors, all came from this 6 million people that we didn't have anymore. And so the Yiddish theater started to pass out. Now, they kept saying the Yiddish theater is dying, and we hadn't been on the street on Second Avenue for a few years. And our delegate from the union called and said, "Yankel, you've got to put on another Yiddish play to bring the theater back to life again." And so we did. We put on a new play, and it sold out every night. And so once a lady came on a Sunday, and she said, "I want 2 seats in the front downstairs." And the cashier said, "I'm sorry, madam, we are sold out." Well, you know, if you hit her with a bomb, she couldn't have been more surprised. She said, "What do you mean you're sold out? I come from the Bronx. He's sold out." He said, "Yes, madam, we sell out every night." She said, "That's why the Yiddish theater is dying." Now you can see the humor and the bewilderment of it. But now, this I say with great joy, because we had almost lost the language. Even I, who spoke it so well, I hadn't spoken and played in Yiddish for 30 years. And my English is pretty good. I watch it because I don't want it to sound Yiddish when I don't need it to sound Yiddish. But now there is a great interest again in the language, and young people are coming to me. "Why don't we laugh when you laugh? What have we missed? What is it?" They want their roots, like the black people. And so they're beginning to study. I did a concert at Queen's College just recently, all in Yiddish. Now, I hadn't worked in Yiddish for years and years. It took me 3 weeks to get it on my lips, to get it in my mind, to get it in my body, so I could play back in Yiddish, because the American theater is quite different. And it was such a success, I can't tell you. It was just thrilling the whole evening. It was like electricity in the theater. And I see now, wherever I go, they come, "Molly, what is this and what is the other?" And they're studying all over the country. They had 400 students in Queen's College that were studying. They're studying all over the country. And we are a stubborn people. We are a people of survival, as you know, or we wouldn't be here today. We will survive, and we will bring back that language, I'm sure, because the young people want it, and they need it, to have some identity.
Do you feel that there was a period when American Jews born in America were a little bit embarrassed by Yiddishkeit?
Yes, I suppose so. You know, there was always anti-Semitism. And even today, you know, we see the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazis marching in, where was it, near Boston somewhere?
Oh, Skokie.
Yes.
Illinois.
And so there, it's around. Now, this is another reason why we survive, because the minute we are thrown into a situation, then we get together. You know who told me that? Isaac Bashevis Singer. I was on a show with him recently. I was on two, actually, on Ellis Island, and he was speaking about the fact that Yiddish is very difficult. He writes in Yiddish, but he doesn't publish in Yiddish anymore because there aren't enough people who read, so he can't sell a Yiddish book. But he writes in Yiddish, and then they translate into English. And he was telling me a very interesting observation. We are the only people that survived and lived through so many years without a country, until Israel, without a country. No matter where we went, we brought along our Yiddishkeit, because we were being persecuted, and that kept us together. The family kept us together. Charity kept us together, because we were taught from childhood, Tzedukah Tatzel Mamuvis in Hebrew. This means that the charity will prevent you from death, will save you from death. And we were brought up like that. So these things keep us together. And the more we are persecuted and thrown out of a society, the more we will survive, because we are pushed together. I think, personally, if we were left alone and accepted all over the world, I think in two generations we would disappear, because we assimilate very easy. But either they don't want us to disappear. We must have been put here for some reason. Do you know why? I don't. I think it's for the morals that we brought to the world, for the Ten Commandments. And I think that's one of the reasons they don't like us, because we give them all the don'ts. Don't do this and don't do the other.
Molly Picon is my guest, if you're just joining us, and she's here on the occasion of the publication of her autobiography, which is called Molly. Is there anything that you feel you could say in Yiddish that will come across in a certain way that you can't capture in English?
Oh, there's so many things. The word nachas, when you have joy in a child, nachas, it's beautiful. It is a very rich language, and it's a peculiar language, because in every country, the language of the country slipped into the Yiddish, somehow infiltrated. Now, I was in Paris, we were playing there, and there was a very famous restaurant near the Folie Bergère called Madame Flambaum's. So I went in, I said to the lady in Yiddish, "Madame Flambaum, was hat ihr heinz essen? What have you got to eat today?" And she said to me, "Wir haben toujours kreplach." Now, there you have a mixture of French and Yiddish, you know. And very naturally, you know, it came. And so we have that in every language, in every country. Some of the language of the country has filled into the Yiddish and made the Yiddish so much richer and so much more amusing, because toujours kreplach is a very funny expression, you know. So that's why Yiddish is such a wonderful language. It's alive, it's vibrant, it's human, and it's humorous, and has a lot of pathos in it. And personally, I love the language, and anybody that knows it loves it.
I know after World War II, when the survivors were freed from the concentration camps, you did a tour and performed for survivors. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like? You talk about it a bit in your autobiography.
Well, it's very difficult to describe it, because until today, I don't believe that I saw what I saw. I cannot accept what I saw has actually been. We walked into an oven somewhere in Poland, and we picked up a sole of a baby shoe and a page, a torn page of the Torah, of the Talmud. Now, there they were, and to think that these were two people that walked into an oven and were burnt, and, you know, you cannot absorb it. Of course, the story I always tell is that in one of those concerts, we gave free concerts for 6 months, the uncle and I, wherever we could find people. And let me tell you, we dressed up in the finest clothes, makeup and everything, as if it were nothing to do with a situation. And all we were out there for was to make them laugh and make them enjoy. We made no mention of what had happened. We gave a concert as if nothing had happened. And the people responded, but it took a little time for them. Now, in Paris, our first performance was in Paris at the Sarah Bernhardt Theatre, and they came and said they had some children, there was no seat, so Yankel said, put them on the stage, you know, it doesn't matter. They had 300 children there that they brought from Varennes, which was a little colony of children, and they put them in the back, and we were singing in front. And in the middle of our program, Yankel felt that the children were getting restless. So he said, Molly, let's cut it, you know, and see what's wrong. And so he cut the show and brought the curtain down. All those kids rushed to the front and picked up the curtain, looked underneath, and we said, what is it, children? One of them said, I think I saw my mother. Another one said, I think I saw my father. I think I saw, they were looking for their parents. Now, can you imagine what that does to a person? All these little kids. And of course, in the camps, one night a woman came with a child, and the child was crying, and Yankel said, why did you bring a child to a concert? And the lady said, my child is 2 years old, and she's never heard the sound of laughter. Can you imagine a world where children have never laughed? Well, you know what that does to you. It took us a year to get over this whole thing, and even until today, I don't believe it. A little boy came up to me, he said, I have an uncle in Yiddish, of course he spoke, in New York, and he would bring me there if he knew where I was. So Yankel said, all right, give me the address, and I'll... So he says, oh, I've got it, and he had it all written out, and he gave it to us, and Yankel had given them a pencil, what he said. So and then he said, and you can keep the pencil. And the youngster, he was about 4 or 5 years old, he said, the whole pencil? The whole pencil for me? How can you have a whole pencil? Or in the camps, they told us, they wore wooden clogs. And when they had to march or something, if somebody didn't have them tied on securely and slipped and fell, they beat them. And they used to fight over a shoelace among themselves, because survival. Because if they fell, they would be beaten or killed. And all these things, you know, and in Paris, too, there was a fight in the gallery while we were performing. And after the show, one woman said, you see what Hitler taught us? A Jew was fighting another Jew because he thought he was one of the Jews that had beaten the people in the camps. And all these horrors, and when I think or talk about them now, they come back to me. But I don't believe them. I do not believe that what happened, but it did.
How did those experiences affect your performances when you came back to America and just resumed your career here?
Well, it took us, as I say, a lot of time, and we devoted almost a year to making money for the children and sending toys and things to them. And then we came out of it slowly and began to live normal lives. But all through our lives, we always felt that this was the high point of our life in the theater, of what we had done in the theater, because we did make people laugh. We brought them little packages that we made, and you know, everybody laughed at us when we started going. We were going to make them packages of maybe a lipstick and needles and cottons and threads and little gloves and all the things they hadn't had in 7 years. And they said, oh, they don't need that. What they need is food. And Yanko said, the societies will give them food, Hayas and the others. But I said, if I were a woman who for 7 years hadn't had a lipstick, I would want a lipstick when I came out of this. And so we made these little packages, and they were tied with beautiful paper and everything. And people from all over the country sent us things to send to them. And that's what we gave them. And you know that until today, very often I come into a city and a lady walks up to me in a beautiful mink coat and opens it up and shows me a little tin thing that I sent her, a little pin of some kind, says, see, this is what you brought us in the camps. So that these things made such an impression on them. When I think of them now, I'm going to start crying.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about one of your films that is very popular now. A friend of mine was just telling me that she saw it and that she was just really amazed at what a wonderful film it was. I wish I had seen it, but I didn't have the opportunity to do it. The movie is Yiddelmit the Fiddle. Mm-hmm. That was shot in Poland. Can you tell us a little bit about the movie? Because it's a very important classic now.
Yes, it was shot in 1936. And let me tell you that in 1970, or when did we make Fiddler on the Roof? Maybe a little later. Jewison, who was making the film Fiddler on the Roof, went to Israel because Yiddel was in the archives there to look at it, to get the feeling of the shtetl, the little town, of the wedding, of the food, of the dancing. So he went there to see this film. And when he came back, and we were filming Fiddler then, he said, Marlene Yankel, to my husband, this film is 50 years ahead of its time. That's why it stands up today. First of all, it's in rags. We're ragged musicians that play in the backyards. And she dresses up as a boy so she can play with her father and not be molested by men. And then it turns out she falls in love, you know, that the story is not important. But what's left of that is the last of jewelry. There is no such thing anymore in the world today as that one film that has the whole picture of Warsaw, of Lodz, of Kazimierz, where the film was filmed. This is all gone. This whole life is gone. Nobody has any kind of remembrance of these towns but what's in that film. And it's, for that reason, it's very important. Beside which, it is still a very good film. It's amusing. And it isn't dated because, as I say, we were all in ragged costumes. You know, sometimes clothes will date a film. The music is beautiful, written by Abel Stein on the folk tunes. So he took that little folk song and made a whole chorus of it. And whenever people see it, they always come to tell me how wonderful the film is and how they enjoy it. And it'll go on forever because this is all that's left of that jewelry.
It must be really exciting for you to have some of your performances like that preserved on film, because what you did in the Yiddish theater, we can read about, we can hear stories about it, but we can't see it. We can still see the movies.
Oh, yes, that one. And the next one was Mamala, which is also a good film, but I don't think quite as good as Yiddel. Yiddel has more folk thing in it.
I'd like to ask you to tell a story to us that I think a lot of our women listeners particularly will be able to relate to. And it's a story that you tell in your book about when you confronted Yanko with the fact that you thought he was being a little too patronizing towards you and you wanted a little more control and you wanted to be able to be a little more assertive within your
relationship. No, it was another thing. You know, it is a little difficult to handle success. When a performer comes out from a performance and is already high from the applause and everything, and he's rushed at by 10 or 12 nice-looking young people who want an autograph, and you start signing, you're still acting, really, and forget very often who's behind you, who made you what you are today, you know. And so very often I did that, and that Yanko was very hurt by that. And one time in the dressing room, we had some very important people, and they were talking to me, and Yanko stood there, and I never said, this is Yanko, my Yanko, you know, I never mentioned him. And he walked out and left me a note. He was going away. It was finished, you know. And I said to myself, oh, my God, this can't happen. What did I do? And so I followed him. I went to the hotel and I said, come on, Yanko, what's wrong? What did I do? And he told me. And I said, you're right. And I didn't realize, see. And so that I was the one that always brought us back together because he was sensitive. He had a beautiful, sensitive soul. And he was hurt by my neglecting him this way. Now, it was the only kind of neglect that I did, because I was too much taken. I was still acting. You see, I was not myself anymore. And he began to understand, and so the two of us would talk things out. I think that if you are honest and you talk things out, you can always remedy any failure in your life. And people should do that more often. You shouldn't just close up and get angry. Anger is a very bad thing. I'm very sorry for people who have so much anger in their systems. I didn't have that. And I knew that he was responsible for what I am today.
You probably saw a lot of theater relationships fall apart.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, more so in the American theater than in the Yiddish theater. We seem to have stuck together more in the Yiddish theater because we worked together in shows. Of course, some of the marriages did break up, but not too many, really, not too many. I think Tomaszewski was the one that divorced his wife and married another woman. But Adler went through, in spite of all of his amours that he had on the side, but he always came back to his wife, to Sarah, and they were two great actors. And so that we didn't have too much divorce in the Yiddish theater, as we have in the American theater today.
If I may mention your age, Molly Picon, you are 82 now. Mm-hmm. A lot of people worry about what it's going to be like for them when they get older. Yeah. How is aging for you?
I don't have time to get old. I am too busy. And I have, every morning when I get up, I have something to do and I bounce at it because, oh my God, I have to, be there on time. And it doesn't let me grow old. But I have limitations. I cannot do today what I did 2 years ago, just 2 years ago, the first time my doctor said, Molly, no more somersaults, because I had a little trouble with my ears and, a little this or the other. And he said, maybe it's the somersaults to do it, so no more somersaults. And then I tell my story, which I've told often, about the old woman who came to a rabbi. She said she'd been married for 65 years and she wanted a divorce. And he said, after 65 years, a divorce, why? And the rabbi, and she answered, because enough is enough. And that's the way I feel about certain things. And Yankel, too, he steered me right towards this, too. I was very cute, and I was very flexible, and you could do anything with me. I was like putty. He always said that. And then at a certain time, he started saying, Molly, don't be cute anymore. It's not becoming. If you've watched Jerry Lewis, his little things that he did that were so funny when he was younger are not as funny anymore because he's outgrown them. And that's what Yankel told me, Molly, you'll outgrow it. Don't be funny any. Don't be cute anymore. Learn to be an actress, see. And this I discovered when I did Majority of One in Miami. With a new director, and he started taking out the laughs. We had always played the show for laughs, because I did it first with Robert Morley, who was a comedian, and then with Green from the Savoyards. He was a comedian. Yankel directed it for comedy and worked towards the comedy. And this young director said, no, Molly, I don't want the comedy. I want the people. I want this Jewish woman and this Japanese man. How did two such characters get together? And he started taking out a laugh wherever a laugh came in that didn't belong. And I came to Yankel, I said, he's killing the show. And Yankel said then, he's a young man, he has new ideas. Try it out. If it's no good, we'll put the laughs back tomorrow, And so he tried it out. And for the first time, I got a standing ovation with this part, without the shtick, not all these things. And Yankel came up, and for the first time, he said, Molly, tonight I saw an actress on the stage. And that's how he led me through my whole life. And just by telling me, this is right and this is wrong. Now, Jerry doesn't have anybody to tell him that, you see, or other actors. Or they are so certain in their own minds that they're right that they don't listen. But I always listen to Yankel.
Let me ask you, since you're still... You've been performing, you just wrote your book, you're touring around the country right now. How do you feel about things like mandatory retirement or people leaving their jobs at 65, not necessarily because they want to?
Well, I wish there were enough jobs so that we wouldn't be depriving the younger generation of these jobs. On the other hand, those that really have something to give in and have taken so many years to learn that, it would be awful if you would take all the old actors that are such good actors, Olivier or Gilles Gould. If you would stop them from acting, it would be awful for the younger people because we learn from them. Now, how we can cover this thing with the economics, I don't know. See, this is what we have to find out, how still to keep those people who are still doing a good job, who still have something to offer, past 65, past 75 even for that matter, and still give the young people a chance to make a living too, to get somewhere. I don't know. I'm not smart enough to find the answer to that.
I'd just like to know what some of your favorite films are, since we can go back and see your films, and as I said, we can only talk about the theater, we can't see it. Which are your favorites?
Well, I liked Come Blow Your Horn with Frank Sinatra. It was a very good part for me, and Frankie was very good to work with. And they produced what they filmed, came out. Now, I've done other films. I did one with Barbara Streisand, which was a very good part. But she cut me out of the last half because her part with me in that last half was not good enough for her. So she cut it out. So the part is just not enough, you see. So this often happens with films. But Frankie, he was wonderful to work with. And I wear a pin that he gave me because after the show, he gave the girls in the show all the gowns that Edith had made. And each gown was worth $2,000 or $3,000. And all I wore was a little black dress. And so I said to him, you know, Frankie, that's unfair. Look what you give them, what you give me, this little black dress. So he went out and had a horn made for me, which I have on this little thing here.
Oh, yeah. That's
nice. With diamonds and rubies, yeah, and so forth, and gave that to me because he appreciated, you know, the work I had done. And so that I am not a film person, really. I like the theater. I like the instant response, the instant applause. And I know immediately whether I'm doing my job or not doing my job. In films, you never know. I did a film with Anthony Quinn. And we filmed at night. He was a gangster, and I was his mother, and he wanted me to give him money, and I didn't want to give it. And this was only over the phone. He did 30 takes with me. 30 times we took it. But then they finished, and they gave me my money, and I went home. And a week later, they called me up and said they were sorry they had to cut my sequence out because the film was too long. And it was the only one that they didn't really need for the picture. So I said, look, this is your business. But you know that every time they do it now, I get residuals and I'm not in the film. This part of it I like.
Right. Yeah. Well, Molly Picon, it's been a real treat to meet you. I thank you so much for coming to Fresh Air. Good luck with your autobiography, and I hope that you enjoy your travels. Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to meet you.
And great pleasure to work with you, young lady.
Oh, thank you. I've been speaking with Molly Picon, and she has just written her autobiography, and it's called Molly. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.